Welcome to Wolfpack Women. I'm your host, Denise, and today we have Debbie Dubois. She is the head of BBC Sports Production, but she's also the mother to Harry, who died suddenly at the age of 17. I wanted to speak to Debbie to talk about her story and her message to other mothers. Death is difficult at the best of times, but when it's your children, the pain is so much more. I'm so grateful to have you on the show, Debbie, and I know this is been like a tremendous amount of pain that you and your family have suffered, and I really appreciate it because it is a difficult story to tell. But first of all, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Really well. Good to finally get around to doing this. I know we spoke a few weeks ago, and yeah, I just think it is difficult, but I think you know, what we experience as a family and where we've got to, and that journey through grief and trying to find some positives in that and to share that story is really important. So, hopefully it'll give people an insight, and perhaps also just, I suppose, the thing that we've learned actually is that it's grief sort of changes, which is quite obvious really, but how you feel, you know, in the immediate aftermath with grief, particularly with a child and the shock that we felt, and that journey through the first year and kind of how you work through that individually and as a family, and where we are today is, you know, something that I wanted to share with people.
Did you ever have any fears of him dying before, like when he was a baby? I know that I used to have fears of my son. That's why I ask. Did you ever, yeah. Did it even cross your mind? Was it something?
No, not at all. And I think the thing is that you have those natural worries as a parent. You know, you think about the stages of life and, you know, when they sort of transition from being a baby, they leave kind of like your care to go to nursery, or they move through the natural progression of school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Harry was at that stage of life. He was on the cusp of moving from, you know, young adult into his next stage of life, which was, you know, actually university. And so you worry about the normal things. Are they going to get the grades they need? Have they got a good group of friends? Are they happy? The exam stresses. It's all the kind of normal stuff, really, isn't it? But nothing at all that would have suggested that there was anything that we would need to be concerned about, because he was well and he was healthy. So it was just the normal everyday stuff that any parent worries about, I think.
And yeah, I mean, you mentioned that he was well. I mean, with a condition like he had, there's no clues, right? Unless you get tested, is that right?
That's, yeah, correct. So he, you know, Harry had, unbeknownst to us, a heart condition that, as it turned out, obviously, was fatal. And he didn't have any warning signs. You know, he was healthy. He was, you know, in terms of his kind of general well-being and his physical state, he was exactly as you would expect him to be. And I think the only perhaps warning sign came 48 hours actually prior to Harry passing away, was that he'd had this kind of really strange incident at home, where I'd found him in his bedroom, and he actually thought he'd fallen over his bag. And he was sort of slightly dazed and unconscious. And then he came to quite quickly. And we actually did call for an ambulance just as a kind of precaution, because we couldn't quite understand what was going on. And they checked him over and said, oh, you know, it was muscle spasm, and sent him on his way. And that was it. That was the first sign, actually. Mm. But there were no kind of, nothing showed up at the hospital. But I think it was, in terms of the checks that they did, I think it was quite routine, to be honest.
I mean, muscle spasm, that muscle, yeah. Spasm, like, we've all had muscle spasm.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like a muscle spasm, no. when you say it.
No, and they basically, you know, their kind of, their view was that, oh, he'd pulled a muscle, and that he was suffering pain in his upper back. Because of this pulled muscle, and sent him home with painkillers. But of course, what we came to learn afterwards and in the following 48 hours, you know, so he was resting up at home, And I was actually going, I had an event at work in London, the London Marathon that I was, you know, part of. And so I left on the Friday morning thinking he'd pulled a muscle, had gone off to London, and unbeknownst to us, what had actually happened was that his aorta had torn, which was part of actually in the end his aorta dissecting. So at that point, for those 48 hours without intervention, you know, and that's actually what's quite hard when you look back now, is that in those 48 hours, you know, had he have got medical attention, things may have been different. And I went off to London completely unaware of this, and then received a call on the Saturday to say that he had, my husband phoned to say he'd collapsed at home. And at this point, I was hundreds of miles away, couldn't make any sense of this. Immediately, you know, got somebody at work to arrange a car and made the journey back. And I think the fact that, you know, I didn't get a call back from anybody in the family in that time, I knew really when I arrived at the hospital, I knew that it wasn't going to be a positive outcome. And of course, you know, the shock of just and not actually being there in that moment as well, and for my husband to be there on his own and to kind of be faced with that, I think that's something probably that initial just the rawness of it and that feeling that he had at that point is probably never really kind of left him, you know, because as much as I sat in the car and came back and probably knew what I was going to be facing when I got back, it wasn't something I actually witnessed, and it wasn't that horror sort of unfolding and everything that medically they tried to do to save Harry. I didn't see, you know, you can imagine that, but actually that's very different, isn't it, than experiencing that firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking about this yesterday, not your specific thing, but just like hearing stories, and you hear people's stories, you know, when you're coaching, and you obviously, it's a lot of stories aren't nice, and you kind of, you sympathize, but it's a story at the end of the day, and when you don't experience it, you don't quite grasp it. You get that there's emotions behind it. There's nothing you can do personally to change it. I saw something like horrible, and I was like, wow, that's what the reality of seeing something versus not seeing it and hearing about it. The visual stimulation is much more like, it's graphic, isn't it?
Yes.
And it can stay with you, like the images.
And I think it's that probably the sheer panic as well, you know, in that moment, for my husband to be sat and they were just watching TV on the sofa, and then, you know, to see Harry collapse, and then to try and find some way of, you know, kind of trying to save him, and at the same time phoning an ambulance, at the same time trying to get hold of me, all of those things together, and that sort of sheer panic of what was happening, I think that sort of stays with you, doesn't it? That you can't lose that, and you can't forget that, and I think that's probably been for him one of the hardest things actually that he's had to manage, you know, mentally and emotionally.
It's a trauma, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's exactly that. And I think, you know, that whole kind of post-traumatic stress and how you cope with that in the sort of days and months afterwards. And it's that thing, isn't it, when you close your eyes at night and what is it that comes to mind? And you sort of replay those things, don't you, over and over. And the what ifs, you know, what if when he went to the hospital on Thursday, on that Thursday night, and they did more than just a basic check, you know, and thinking that had they have done that and had they picked something up, would the outcome have been different? And that takes you to quite a dark place sometimes, I think.
And how have you gone through this process, like coming out of it, being able to articulate yourself is a massive thing, right? Especially being
I mean, I think that is probably one of the big things I've learned, is that actually you can experience, and of course Mario and I's experience, although the outcome was the same for both of us, we lost our child, or we lost our son, that evening, and what we experienced was quite different. And also, I suppose, for me, I kind of channeled my, I mean, the immediate priority was, okay, we had to have a post-mortem, we had to understand what had happened. And then after that, it was really, you know, it was the practical stuff, arranging the funeral, you know, and something that you just never think you will do for your child. And then once we'd got through that on a day-to-day basis, it was trying to understand what had happened. You know, I got quite into the, okay, so it's an aortic dissection, and then medically everyone was telling me this is so rare, that doesn't happen, it has to be a genetic condition. So then it was like, right, we need to get to the genetics clinic. And so I went into quite a sort of practical mode, and then immediately I started, well, like once I started to understand, and we'd asked initially, because we knew it was a heart condition, for people to make donations to the British Heart Foundation. But actually, when I realized quite quickly that a lot of what they do is directed at older, you know, and heart disease, that didn't feel right. So then I found out about this organization called CRY, which is, you know, cardiac risk in the young. Then I started to read that 12 young people every week die of an undiagnosed heart condition. And I was thinking, how did I not know this? How did I not know as a parent before that this could happen? Then I started to read stories of young people and did some research. And just the more I read and the more that I started to look at it, and to realise that, you know, if you screen young people, you can pick up some of these conditions. Then I was like, well, how did I not know you could have your child screened? So that was my sort of focus. And then we went into fundraising and so on. And I suppose I probably dragged Mario with me, because at that point he was just still in this absolute state of shock and disbelief. And then I had this moment where, it was probably about 8 weeks after we'd lost Harry, and I was driving with my daughter in the car, and I've never been one for going to the gym or keeping fit. That's just not me. I've never had that interest. Then I decided, a colleague had retrained as a personal trainer, and suddenly lots of people wanted to do runs in Harry's name. So then I thought, I need to get fit. Not that I don't think I ever had any intention of doing a run, but I started going to the personal trainer with my daughter. And this particular day I got in the car, and it'd been a really difficult week, because we'd had the appointment at the genetics clinic. It was what would have been Harry's graduation from school day, so we've got that to attend. And there was just a host of things that week, and I think it was all starting to become a bit overwhelming. And got in the car to drive to the trainer with Emily, and I wasn't quite sure of where we were going, so I put the sat nav on the screen in the car, and I just set off. I've not been going very far, and it fell off the screen, and I went to grab it, and as I did, I don't know, I just lost control of the car, drove into a set of traffic lights, brought the traffic lights down, wrote off my car in the process. And I'll never forget, the car sort of started, you know, steam's coming out of the car, and Emily was so calm, actually, and she got me out of the car. And I remember just standing on the road with the car and the traffic lights in the middle of the road, and this guy just coming up and saying, what on earth has happened? And I just absolutely lost it. And the poor guy must have thought, I wish I'd never stopped, because I was literally wailing like a banshee, and I was just, and he was kind of like, what on earth have I, what have I done here? And I remember Emily gathering all the belongings up in the road into this plastic bag I had in the car, and we walked back to our house, and couldn't speak to the guy on the insurance line, and I just couldn't stop crying. And then the police appeared at the door, because the traffic lights are obviously in the middle of the road, and somebody, I don't know how they found that, through the license plate, obviously they must have found my address. And this guy, the policeman, appeared at the door, and I opened the door, and he said, what's happened here? You know, you took some traffic lights down, you've not reported it. And I was in floods at the door. And then he said, sorry, I don't understand you. And I said, my son's died. And he just, it was literally, and I think it was, you know, I'd sort of been on this absolute, like, you know, this is what I need to do. I'm just, you know, very practical. I'm going to do this, 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 and this. And then I think that moment, that day, was the absolute sort of implosion of the last, you know, the previous 8 weeks of where I just held it together. I think it was kind of like, you know, however much you try and focus your mind and try and approach it from a kind of, okay, what can I do practically? And as I say, I really needed to understand with the sort of post-mortem result that we got and what that meant for us as a family. But then there's a point, isn't there, at which you reach that you can't just keep doing that, and suddenly something happens. There was I remember the other one as well was that it was my brother's birthday, and I'd gone into the post office locally to get him a birthday card, and it was absolutely packed. And I'd asked where the brother section was, and she pointed me in the direction. And I was in the post office, and I was looking at the brother cards, and suddenly I had this absolute overwhelming sort of just moment of where the reality hit me, and I just thought, Emily's never going to buy Harry a brother card for his birthday again. And I'm in this post office and it's packed. And I just, again, you know, it was like this kind of wailing banshee in the middle of the post office. And this poor woman is like shuffling me into the back, the staff room. And she's like, whatever's the matter? And, you know, and I think that's the thing with grief, is that you can control, you know, over time, I've obviously learned that there are certain triggers for me, and I have to know what they are. And birthdays are always anniversaries. I always take a week around Harry's anniversary off work. I take the days before and the days after. I don't put myself in a position at work where I need to speak to people around that time, because I can't predict how I'm going to feel. And as time goes on, you know, the first year people remember anniversaries and birthdays, but as time goes on, it's not that they forget, but you know, they've kind of moved on a bit, and they don't necessarily think that that's going to be a trigger for you. So you have to just remove yourself from the situation, really, because that's the best way to protect yourself. And so, you know, I always make sure I'm off on Harry's birthday, I'm off on his anniversary, and I take time around that. You know, Christmas is easier because pretty much everyone's off at that time. But, you know, there will be triggers, and sometimes you can't predict them. And certainly in the early days, I couldn't tell you at any given point in time when I might, you know, just be in floods of tears. And that's the thing, is that when you sort of emerge from that period of mourning, and what even is mourning, you know, it's that period of time that in society it's acceptable that this is kind of where you are. But as you start to come out of that, and try and reintegrate yourself into some sort of whatever your new life, you know, the new normal looks like without the family unit that you had previously. You're kind of in this place of limbo. I always said the first few years, I feel like I don't really fit in anywhere, because, you know, the friends that you've got, you know, and our friends were brilliant, but, you know, friends who've got kids of a similar age sometimes are wary of talking about them because they feel it's going to be really hard for you. And you're kind of stuck in this sort of strange place where the life you had before isn't what it was. You know, we were all massively displaced because Emily had come home from her year abroad, and she never ended up going back, you know, to finish that part of her degree. Then she had to take a leave of absence from uni, and I'd have gone to Brazil actually the year that Harry passed away to work on the World Cup. And it was like we'd all been going on this sort of, you know, path, and suddenly we lost Harry, and we all, just all of our lives changed. You know, none of us were where we were going to be at that point in time. Harry's journey hadn't continued, and at each point, you know, in the September, I remember finding September really difficult. Harry passed away in the April. And September was when all of his friends went to uni. And And even now, I get really frustrated when people post on Facebook, you know, oh, my child's going to university. Oh, it's dreadful. I don't know how I'm going to cope. Because you think, well, you can pick up the phone. You can speak to them. You can text them. They'll come home on holidays. You're not going to not be able to see them in some guise or other. And so it's hard because you can't relate to other people because that seems really quite trivial to you because ultimately they're just going to uni. And to that parent is quite a big deal. And I remember when Emily went to uni how I felt. But now, to me, that doesn't seem a big deal because your child's still here. And so that's what I mean when I say you don't necessarily fit in because how you feel isn't how other parents feel. Because they're worrying about things that to you seem, you know, they're not huge. And that's quite hard because you can feel disconnected from people. And, you know, I remember going back to work after 6 months and people would talk about things that they're worried about and what to me seem quite trivial things because it's not life-changing. And that's where the difficulty comes in because you have to be respectful of other people's situation and actually things that to you might seem quite trivial to them actually are important and to me would have been important. So trying to find your place amongst people is not easy actually. And where you fit in and how you manage your grief and how do you reintegrate into daily life? Because there comes a point where if you're going back to work, and I did go back to work after 6 months, you have to be able to do your job. You have to find a way that people don't feel awkward around you. There's so much that you have to navigate through whilst you're still dealing with your own grief.
And did you find a lot of people were awkward around you? I mean, is that not their issue more than yours?
Well, do you know what I did? I mean, before I went back to work, the people I knew I was going to be working closely with, I emailed them directly. I thought, I'm going to head this off for the pass. I could, you know, I sort of thought this could be quite hard. So I just sent them a personal note that said, along the lines of, you know, I'm coming back to work. I just wanted to say that I can't guarantee I'm not going to get upset, but it won't be anything you've said. So please don't, you know, feel like that. And you know, just bear with me because I can't honestly tell you on any given day how I'm going to feel. And actually that was really good thing to, and somebody that I'd met, who's now actually become a really good friend who'd lost her daughter 2 years previously, but I didn't know her at the time. She'd read our story online and they'd lost their daughters to the same condition and they reached out and contacted us through the newspaper. And they were an absolute godsend because they had to have 2 years and they were so, you know, supportive but also helped navigate through that journey. And they gave us that sort of tip and just said, look, you know, people are going to feel difficult and uncomfortable and you might think it's not your job to make them feel better about that, but it might just make it easier for you. So that really helped. But there were people who, when I went back, didn't know what to say. You know, I mean, work were brilliant. And at the time, my line manager, who I'd known for a long time, she was so supportive and came and visited me and made life, you know, I went back on a phased return plan and, you know, they kind of gave me a little seat somewhere that was a bit out of the way and, you know, everything that they could possibly do to make life easier. And I was put on projects rather than specific programs. But I do remember being sat on this desk this day and this chap was facing me who I didn't work that closely with, but, you know, I knew him to have a conversation with. And for 3 months I sat when I came back to work and faced him and he never once acknowledged my presence. Yeah, and then there were other people who I used to call it the oh shit face because literally they would see me coming towards them and there was multiple sort of approaches, but they would either really need to go to the toilet quickly or dive into the lift, or they would suddenly be on their phone. And it was just to avoid speaking to you, actually. But they were probably people that I didn't know that well, that I wasn't that close to, that I didn't work that closely with. You know, I have to say in the main, you know, 95% of people were brilliant when I went back to work, and they were so supportive. And that was a massive help, because I don't know how I would have gone back had that have been otherwise. And I think...
But what do you think is it about grief, that what you've been through, that people can't even just say, I'm sorry to hear about your son's death?
I think there is definitely something around the natural order. You know, I think probably people are more comfortable when you perhaps lose a parent, because that's the natural order of life, isn't it? I think the loss of a child, when it's such a shock as well, it's not like anybody, you know. I went off on whatever day it was to go and work on the London Marathon, and suddenly everybody, you know, who I work with gets a call or an email to say this has happened. So I think there was a huge amount of shock. And then just from a personal perspective, for people who have, you know, children of a similar age, just thinking, I don't, you know, people did say to me, I have no idea how you cope, and I couldn't do it. But you actually don't know what you would do, do you, in that situation? Because what's the alternative? You know, we had another child, and what do you do? Do you just say, well, that's it, then life's over for everyone else in the family? And I think that you don't actually know how you would react. Because why would you know? And actually, unless you're in that situation and you're having to deal with it, why would you even go there in your mind to think about how you'd cope with that? Nobody wants to think about that, do they? So I think grief is, we don't talk about death really, do we? And we don't talk about, certainly not, you know, if you think in Victorian times, a loss of a child was much more common. And actually, you know, people could lose, you know, I mean, my grandma, she lost two children, you know, it was something that happened. But as obviously, you know, we've got better with vaccines and medicine, and you know, the quality of life has improved. That isn't normal. It's not, you don't expect somebody, unless, you know, and even then an accident, you know, how often do you get that? So I think it's so outside of the norm, but it's also not something people want to think about. It's too painful.
And death is really painful.
Yeah.
Like I said, I had fears of losing my son, but I had a reading from Louise, an Akashic reading. I don't know if you know about Akashic records, but Akashic records is the book. It's considered the book of life. The record.
Yes.
So every life that you've lived is in the Akashics.
Yes.
So you can access them through a prayer. And so I asked her what my view on money is. And she said that my view of money is dark, that in a past life I was a wealthy man and I lost my son to forfeit to pay off a debt or something. And so it kind of dawned on me, that's maybe why I was scared of losing him. Because
yeah.
I did another podcast with Ramona, and it was the Urban Queen one, and she did a lot of more of a spiritual journey, and she did past life regression. And that came up for her because she had the same fear of losing her daughter, and she'd lost her daughter in a past life.
Okay.
So although I haven't experienced that, I did have feelings of it, but not to the same, obviously. Because obviously what you think and what is actual reality is two different things, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think actually what I've learned over the last few years as well is that it's not... grief isn't something that is confined to a moment in time, that it changes and it grows, and what happens is that you adapt to it and you learn to live with it, but you can also find ways to still have that person that you've lost in your life. So like, you know, when it's Harry's birthday, it's very different when it's his anniversary, because I don't feel that's a cause for celebration, but when it's his birthday, we will always get together with family and raise a glass, and we will see Harry's friends. I mean, it's not been possible this year with the COVID because it was August, but we will have brunch together at his favourite place where they used to go. We've stayed friends with Harry's friends. We see them, you know, we speak with them and so on. And that's been a massive source of comfort, actually. And somebody said to me, do you not find that hard seeing them sort of change and grow? But they're so connected to him that you kind of feel that that carries on. And actually, a friend of Harry's, she wrote a dissertation and she's been out in The Hague, and her mum sent me her kind of, you know, a sort of introduction and her acknowledgements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she put something in there about her friends and her family and blah, blah, blah. And her final sort of line was, you know, always thanks to Harry for being my star and being there. And yes, when I read it, it absolutely, like, you know, I was in floods. But equally, the fact that she has gone, she's overseas, she's moved, you know, to another stage of life, and yet that sense of connection to Harry and wanting to acknowledge his contribution is still there. And that is such a source of comfort, because, you know, they were all, you know, they were just on that cusp, they were just taking their A-levels, they've all gone on to uni, some of them are in London, they're all over now. But that, and actually, really, you know, I feel that that sort of connection with Harry has bound that group that he had of friends together, because often the point of them coming back together when they're home is for Harry's birthday, or so that's had a kind of stronger impact and probably than it might have done had they all just gone off on their separate ways. So yeah, and the friendships, like with Harry's parents' friends, and I did say, actually, there was a friend of mine, and her son got diagnosed as diabetic a couple of years after we'd lost Harry, and took her a little while to tell me. And I said, but, you know, why have you not said? And she was so worried about him. And she said, well, it just seemed really trivial. And, you know, I feel like you've lost Harry and I'm telling you that. And I said, but, you know, he's your son, you're concerned about him and his diagnosis. That doesn't lessen it, because, like, you know, it's not like, oh, well, that's not
it's not big enough tragedy.
Yeah. And that's the other thing I did say, actually, to friends, please don't avoid speaking about your own children, because we won't have what is then a kind of authentic friendship, a real friendship. Because if you're kind of almost, there's things that are off topic and you're kind of, you know, oh, we mustn't mention X, Y, and Z, it's just going to become so unnatural. Yeah. And I didn't want that. I didn't want us to feel like, you know, there's this massive elephant in the room and let's talk about everything but children, because that's difficult for Mario and Debbie. You know, it just, I didn't want that to be. So inviting people and giving them, I suppose, like permission to say, I don't expect that to be off limits, because, you know, that's just not, not going to be helpful, is it? And actually, I think what would have happened is over time we'd have probably drifted away, because it would have been very difficult, you know. But I have, you know, and I think the other thing is as well, is that it's really hard sometimes to think, well, where would Harry be now? What would he be doing? And that's the bit that I suppose I often think about, is I don't know is the answer. You know, he was going to go to uni, he'd chosen Birmingham. Would he have gone there? Would he have changed his mind? Would he have got the grades? Where would he have gone next? What would he be doing now? They're the things that we'll never know, actually. And I'll never probably stop thinking about that. I don't think actually so much now about that time and the kind of absolute trauma of it and the shock of it and the rawness of it, but I do think about the unfairness of how short his life was and all the things that he never did, you know.
Do you feel that space missing, that he should be there all the time?
Yeah, because I feel, you know, he and actually I think what is hard as well is that when you see family members who were younger than him who've now become older, it's like he's frozen, isn't he, at that point in time. And you know, they're all now, you know, they were like 11 or 12 and now they're 18, and it's like, and it really, it messes with your timeline. You know, sometimes you try and you think, well, that can't be right. How is that that they're now this age? And it's a really strange thing. And I think the other thing that's hard, and it's probably harder actually for Emily, because she is at that point of life where you still meet lots of new people, and I've had it a few times actually where people have asked me, you know, who I don't know particularly well, and it always happens in a work environment. And if you go to something externally and there's some sort of dinner and small talk, and people get onto the whole, and I can feel myself working up to this and preempting it, is that, if you've got children, how many children have you got? And I'm already about three questions ahead in my mind, thinking I'm going to have to prepare for this now because of them. Because I will always say I've got two children, and then there's the, so how old are they? So, and then you get to a point, there's nowhere to go with this conversation. And then you have to go, actually, my son isn't here anymore. He passed away. And I'm trying to sort of get this out as quickly as I can. And then I know that they're going to feel horrendous. So before they even say how terrible they feel, I'm saying, look, you know, obviously you weren't to know. And, you know, but it's like a really awkward conversation. And you know, it's coming. You can see the way they'll come. And I'm trying to steer it in another direction, but you can't always. It's not possible. But obviously, like, you know, for our daughter, she will have that more because she's at that stage of life where there's still people that are coming into your life. And yeah, it's hard actually, because what you try and do is you try and make them feel better about the question they've asked. So you're trying to move it on quickly without making them feel difficult and awkward, especially if it's in a work environment. You know, that's quite hard, isn't it? And then some people just really want to move on quickly, and others will just say, well, I hope you don't mind me asking, but, you know, what happened? And, oh, that's terrible. And but, yeah, you do prepare yourself for that question, and you do get ready with your answer to try and get them through that, because you know, they feel terrible that they've put you in this position and that they wish they'd never asked the question.
Mm. And so what about you were talking about the deaths in the UK, like 12 deaths a week.
Yeah.
I remember you mentioning that there was some sort of test that you could do when we were talking about it before, because it could have been like prevented, right?
If it had, yeah. If so, been tested. So basically, there's a very simple 10-minute test, which is an ECG and an echo. But you can't get that done on the NHS. So the frustrating part of this is you would have had to have lost a child, as we have, to get that test, which of course seems madness, doesn't it? Why would you want to be in that position? But there is this fantastic organisation called Cardiac Risk in the Young, and they provide the resources, the equipment, the people. All of these people work in the NHS in the week and then give their weekends to do this. But there's no government funding for them. So they're a charitable organisation, but they rely solely on donations from families like ourselves. So it costs £50 a child to screen them. And then, so we try and do 100 on a weekend or on a day, which means it's £5,000. So our kind of campaign that we created after we lost Harry is 1,000 Hearts for Harry, which is basically 1,000 young people in this area every year to be screened, which means we have to raise £50,000 a year. So it's a huge amount of money, really. And actually this year, you know, as all charities, it's been, you know, we've not been able to do any fundraisers. You know, quite often people will run marathons and 5Ks, and, you know, we probably get 20K a year just from people doing things like that. And then we'll do a big fundraiser. So none of that activity's happened. We haven't been able to do any screenings this year. So it's really hard. But actually, the thing about the screenings is that it is massively positive, because from that we've had a number of young people who've been identified with unknown heart conditions who have then had intervention with either medication or a procedure that has meant the outcome for them has been quite different, and they have no symptoms.
What do you know which countries actually do them? Because I know that, like,
Italy is mandatory, and they've reduced the incident of young sudden cardiac death by, I think it's 85% since they introduced their mandatory screening program.
Yeah, like my friend, she lives in Italy, and her son was diagnosed, and he's had two procedures now. He's fine. But so is it just Italy in the world, or?
I think it is. I think they're the only ones with the mandatory aspect.
How come? Why do you think that is? Is that
I don't know why that their government decided. And also, they're not one of the more kind of, in terms of their, you know, funding model and their, you know, the state of their economy, you wouldn't see them, would you, as one of the kind of the wealthiest nations, but they've prioritised it. And actually, do you know the thing that I've been really shocked at is the number of times we've done our screenings where groups of young athletes, so swimmers and footballers who play, you know, semi-professional, have come and taken advantage of it because they can't access that at. So, you know, obviously, if you play professionally for a club, yes, you'll get all of that. But at grassroots level, that isn't the case. And I mean, we've had people drive 200 miles to come to one of our screenings because they couldn't get one locally. And we've had lovely messages from parents via the CRY organisation to say, you know, that they've got a family history. They've absolutely been worried about this, and the reassurance that they felt having had that test result back, and that, you know, and equally, if people have then had something flagged to say, you know, it's not something that's fatal, but you need observation, intervention, you know. And I think, you know, as a parent, that's probably one of the things that I struggle with, because I think, how did I not know, actually? How did I not know before we lost Harry that this is there? That, because I've now come to understand there are other, you know, young people locally. And there would have been screenings in that time, you know, that we had Harry with us. And I wasn't even aware of them. And actually, if I'm really honest, even if I would have been aware of it, if I'd have seen it, I'd have probably skinned it and thought, oh, well, you know, they don't need that. Why would they need it? Because they're both healthy and well. And I'd have made all sorts of assumptions that would have been completely wrong, that you would know if you needed to have this screening. And I suppose that's the other thing out of all of this, is that, you know, sometimes people think, oh, the raising awareness is about fundraising. And obviously part of it is that, because without the fundraising, we can't do the screenings. But actually, just as important is for people to understand why they should get their child screened. Because we put on screenings sometimes, particularly if we've done them in areas where we're not as well known, or they don't know Harry's story. You know, and I've had a call from CRY, and they've said, oh, you know, we've still got like 30 places and it's this weekend. Can you get the message out there? Can you, you know, tell people? And it's frustrating because you think, well, people don't realise why they should do this and how hard it is to get a screening. You know, that's the frustrating bit of it, that you can put something on, you can raise the money, but if people don't come and they don't realise why it's important, or the other thing that really just drives me, you know, really annoys me, is that you put it on and people just decide not to turn up on the day. And you've paid for that and you've wasted a place. And, you know, the weather was quite nice, so they thought they'd sit in the garden, or they just changed their plans, and they just don't cancel. So I suppose the big part, you know, one of the sort of big parts of it for me as well, is just that promoting and raising awareness, and for people to, if you see in your area that there's a screening, what you have to realise is that behind that screening, somebody's lost a child. The only reason that screening is happening is because a parent or parents have lost their child, and they've tried out of that loss to give something positive to other families, and they've raised that money. they've provided that screening for you. So please take advantage of it and go. And, you know, don't just decide on the day there's something more important to do. Because if you don't do that and you don't, you know, take a bit advantage of it, you might find, you know, like us, that your path that you thought you had for your family and what your future might be is completely different. And it's just a real source of, I suppose, for me, regret that I didn't know that this is something that could happen to what appears to be a healthy child who's about to start adult life with their whole future in front of them and so many journeys to take, so many new people to meet, so many stories, you know, and that thing as well of just, you know, sort of often think of that last day when I left actually to go to London, and I remember Harry being in our bed because he'd got this, you know, muscle spasm, and sort of giving him a hug and saying, "I'll see you when I get back on Sunday night." And I can't believe that the next time that I saw Harry after that was in the A&E department in this room, where, you know, he'd been placed. And I would never speak to him again. And I just, you know, I remember walking into that room and I couldn't believe that when I'd left him on the Friday, that I'd just so casually walked out of the door. And I just, you know, the thought that, I mean, because you think of all the things you should have said, and of course you would never say it because you don't think that that's the last time you're going to see your child alive. So, you know, when you work through all of that and then you think something as simple as this 10-minute test could have changed all of that, it just fills you with so much regret and the guilt that you didn't know, and how could it be possible that you wouldn't have seen any of this. But really, before the Thursday, when we obviously called the ambulance and they said, you know, it was something else, there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing. So, and they're the places that you go to in the dark moments, and you have to work really hard not to stay in that place, actually, because that can consume you, and it's not healthy for you, for anybody in your family, and it's not going to change the outcome for us. But actually all we can do now is change the outcome for another family and make sure that Harry lives on through things, you know, speaking to you, and somebody hears his story and it connects with them and they think, oh, I'm good, you know, I must make sure my child gets checked. And just that he lives on in the stories and the memories that we share, and, you know, from time to time, a friend will post something on Facebook or you'll see something on social media and it might be a photo I've never seen before. It happens less frequently now, you know, but in the first few, you know, 2-3 years, I could see a photo pop up and think, I've not seen that. And the joy that gives you, seeing a picture of your child, because we can't take any more photographs of Harry. You know, there's no more videos that are going to be created now. So when you get something like that, it's like it happened today. You know, it's like that when I see that picture of Harry for the first time, it just feels like that's something new that I didn't have before today. So yeah, there's so many emotions that you feel, and I think as time goes on, the rawness of it subsides, but the loss that you feel actually never leaves you. You know, we'll never not feel the absence of Harry in our family and in our lives, and, you know, I'll never sort of wake up on Christmas Day and not think he should be here. And, you know, you just have to learn to live with that and to manage it and to accept that there might be some days where you really just don't really want to do very much and you don't want to see anybody. Over time, those days become fewer, and the sort of I mean, I still, the thing that I still haven't done, I have a stack of DVDs of Harry and all of his performances at school and outside of school, and they're all in a box. And I still actually haven't watched any of them, because there's something about a moving image that is so much stronger than a photograph. And, you know, occasionally a little clip might pop up on Facebook and I'll see it, and hearing his voice is really hard, actually. Much harder than looking at pictures. And, you know, I think the day that I can take the videos out and watch them might be, you know, a day where I think, well, that's another step that I've taken. But I almost can't, and it might be okay, but I think the fear of it not being okay and how that might leave me feeling is something that at the moment I can't really do. You know, I don't feel ready to do that and to deal with what might be the aftermath of that.
I would have thought the hearing his voice would be almost just take you back and just, I don't know, I thought it would be nice.
I think there's some that I've got of Harry singing on my phone, and I don't know. The strange thing is, the longer that goes on, it's almost like maybe I just have to get beyond that, because the longer it goes on, almost the harder it feels to actually do it. Mm. And
I reckon you'll enjoy it. Maybe we can do a session on it.
Yeah, I probably would. I think it's just that. Maybe sometimes you build things, don't you? And then once it's there, it's that fear thing, isn't it?
I get the sense it would be quite magical for you, because like you'd feel his energy a lot more. Is that, do you sense him around you, like especially after his death, that he was there, or do you have that when it's his birthday or whatever?
I did immediately afterwards. I think the first few months definitely I felt like quite strongly, and there were certain instances where I thought, oh, you know, that is definitely Harry, and it might be, you know, things on the radio or music or so on. I think over time it's got less now, whether that's because I look for it less, you know, and maybe there are things, but I don't notice them as much now. But we got a dog a couple of years ago, which is absolutely the best thing that we did, you know, and she's been brilliant. But there was a particular thing with her and a piece of music that came on that was a piece of music that Harry loved. And as it came on, she just sort of literally got up and she was looking into space, and she was almost transfixed. And it was the most, you know, because I said to Mario, what is she looking at? Oh, actually, no, she'd done the thing of looking up into the mid-distance before the music even came on. And I said, what is she looking at? And then the next thing, this piece of music came on that Harry loved, that we've not heard it's not on the radio now, it's not a current song or anything. And the two things together, it was just that moment of where I thought, that's definitely Harry, you know. You kind of had to be there and experience it, but it was one of those things that just made you stop for a minute. Mm. But I do believe, I genuinely, but you know what, I was brought up with faith. I don't go to church now, but I genuinely think there is something more than what we can see here and beyond, you know, when we're no longer here. And I've definitely felt moments where I felt Harry's presence and things that, and there's been so many people that I feel were pushed in our direction that we were meant to meet through Harry. And, you know, some friends that we've made who read that story have become really good friends. And when we got together with them, I mean, the connections and the similarities and coincidences and places we've been to at the same time. And I mean, honestly, it was quite spooky, you know. So, there's definitely been things that I thought, sort of Harry's intervention or Harry's hand in it, that has guided us to people and places. That we were meant to meet and meant to see and meant to know about.
What do you think in terms of experience, or what have you got out of this, like in respect of, do you see death differently, or do you feel like there's a lesson there that you've learned? Is there something that you've gained as much as you've lost?
I think definitely there is something beyond, you know, where we are now. I think I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because we all, I mean, I've never sort of mapped out my life. I've never been one of these people who thought I'd do this for the next 3 years and then I never planned when I was going to have the kids or what I was doing at work. It's all just kind of slightly evolved. But, you know, I think it does make you realise that often you have all these ideas about what you're going to do and, you know, you can waste an awful lot of time thinking about things in the future that might never happen, actually. And things will be great if this happens or when you do this or if you're in this place or when you move house. And actually, all you really have is the here and now, isn't it? You know, you can spend an awful lot of time thinking about things that are 6, 12 months, 2 years down the line. And so, I mean, you can't be Pollyanna about it and get up every day and even if it's a terrible day, think, oh, I must be grateful for today because this might be my last day. And, you know, of course, the reality of life isn't like that and there are things that happen to you on a daily basis that grind you down. But I think it's given me perspective. There's things that I probably stressed about before that I just now think are really not that important. And I do think you can waste an awful lot of time thinking about things that might never happen, good or bad, actually. So I think you do have to be grateful for what you have and try and be a bit more in the moment, which I think because we're all so busy, it's quite easy to forget, actually. You know, you're all on this hamster wheel and you don't think about the here and now often. You just it's on this, you know, constant churn. And I also think that, you know, one of the things about Harry Ward, he absolutely was somebody who loved life. You know, he had a great sense of humour. He laughed so much. He loved music and dancing and theatre and all that. And that's the bit, actually, that I really miss is that kind of infectiousness of, you know, if he was in the house, there was that kind of radiating energy from him. But I suppose what it's made me realise is that you can carry on somebody's story even if they're not here. So Harry was a real keeper of trinkets, as we used to call it. Even when he was like a magpie when he was a small child, anything that glittered, he'd be there, he'd hover. And he would keep tickets and receipts and programmes of everywhere he'd been. And, you know, he'd got a box with them in and what we've done since is that anytime we go anywhere, he loved key rings and those like globe things, you know, with the snow. So we just always pick one of those up when we go somewhere. We keep our theatre tickets, you know, I never did, or programmes. And the box that he had with these things in, we've carried it on. And we've built and added to it. And, you know, every time we go somewhere, we just come back and we've got that box in Harry's room and we put things in. And even though it's not Harry doing those things, you know, he's we're kind of trying to make that part of his memory box so that he might not have physically been there with us, but I like to think in spirit he was there. And just lots of little things like that, actually, that we've tried to do. And still at Christmas, you know, I will buy him a few presents. And I know there's music that comes out and I think he would have wanted that or a book. Because he's such a reader as well, an avid reader. So I'll buy some books and that I know he would have liked to read them myself, or, you know, just things like that, really. And when we do a fundraiser, we always do a toast to Harry and we always tell his story. And so and the fact that we still talk about him and that his name is still discussed and that friends still share stories and want to make him part of their next stage of life means that he's still here, really. You know, because and I remember when we lost Harry, we got so many cards and letters and people shared personal stories and people that we'd known for a long time. But I didn't know that there was a guy that my husband was friends with through work, and he'd lost his brother when he was younger. And he wrote this letter about his parents and how they dealt with it differently. And his mum had never spoken of his brother again. And she'd, you know, had an early death, really, because she was in this state of grief that she never came out of. And he was never mentioned again. And that absolutely terrified me, the thought that we would never talk about Harry, nobody would mention his name, and as if he never existed. And so that would be the worst of all for me, and that was the thing that I absolutely didn't want. So it was kind of like, well, as long as we talk about him and we share the stories and we remember him and we take him with us, then he's still here. Nobody's going to forget about him, and he's not going to be this person in our family who never existed to all intents, because his name's never mentioned.
Yeah, I definitely feel that, because when I've heard or seen other people who've lost somebody that they love, it's like, it's just an anniversary, but I mean, it's not necessarily their child, although I know friends who have lost like younger, like 4 or 5, but I'm not necessarily close to them. The way that they talk about their children, either they don't mention it just on their, or they would have been this age, or the sadness that they feel, but it just feels totally different. It feels like you have really kept him alive. Like he feels part of the family and he's not really gone, if that makes sense. Like, just because you can't see him doesn't mean that he is not there. And it's almost like the more you do that, the more you guys are all much more connected in that way. That's what it feels like. It definitely feels like that. It doesn't feel like you've lost him. That's what I mean. Yeah.
And I think if you're open and you talk about him in that way, it means other people don't feel awkward if you're in their company about talking of, oh yeah, I remember that time when Harry came to our house. Whereas if it feels like a closed subject that mustn't be discussed, that's off limits, then people are going to shy away from that because they think they might upset you. And that's not to say there haven't been times when we've been in friends' houses and Harry's name's come up and I haven't got upset. But I think you just have to accept that that is part of the grieving process and the loss that you feel. And sometimes you'll have that same conversation with the same group of people, and you can have that, and you can get through that conversation, and there are no tears. And other days, that's not going to be the case.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, actually, you know, that's probably hard for other people, is that they might see you at a point in time and assume you're at a certain place because you're fine or you're not fine. But it doesn't mean the next time they see you, you're going to feel the same. Exactly. And the only way I can explain it really is that it's like anything in life. We all have good and bad days. And, you know, you could see a friend one day and they could be really grumpy. They've had a bad day at work. The kids have been difficult, you know, whatever. And the next time you see them, they might be great and on really good form. And that's the way it is with grief. You know, some days it sits alongside of you. It's there. The loss is there. But you know, it's on that day, it's not causing you huge pain, and you don't feel overwhelmed with sadness, and you go about your business, and it's there with you, and it's sitting alongside of you. And then other days, it's here, you know, it's right, you know, and it's containing you, and you're really struggling to feel good about the world. So, and as I say, over time I think that the extremes become far fewer, but you will still get those moments. And I've just really now come to accept that that's how it is, and I'm not going to fight it, and I'm not going to be worried about it or feel bad that that's how I feel on a given day. That's just the nature of it, and I just, you know, I'm fine with that now.
Thank you so much for talking about this. Is there any sort of advice that you would give to anyone that's listening that may have lost their child, like, recently, or maybe their child's ill and that's what they're scared of losing them?
I mean, I think what I would say is, you know, take all the support you can get. But also, as a family, be mindful that how you grieve isn't how your partner might grieve, isn't how other siblings in the family might grieve. I think you're all on a, you know, yes, you've all suffered the same loss, but your relationship with that person is unique to you. And how you feel and how you want to manage it isn't necessarily how others in the family might want to. So you have to be understanding of that. And you know, if what works for you is speaking to others, then take all the help and support that's offered, you know, and anybody who's an ear, anybody who is happy to come and sit with you, walk with you. I did find actually the first few months that I felt this real feeling of I needed to be outside. You know, every day I would go and have a walk, and just that sort of being outside. And I don't know, there's something about being indoors that felt really claustrophobic. So walking is really good for the soul, I think, and just getting outdoors. And as I say, I got into the sort of probably going to see a trainer 3 times a week. I just found it helped me mentally, actually. I think whatever that thing is for you, and it will be different for everybody, that makes you feel better mentally, you know, do it times 10, because you're going to need all the good stuff that you can get, actually. And try and, you know, it's all a really obvious basic stuff, but, you know, be kind to yourself, eat well, try and get some sleep. You know, I love reflexology. I started going to do that more. If you can meditate, there's so many things, and the mindful apps, but whatever it is that you find helps you, you know, just tap into that and do it frequently and often, because they're the things that are going to keep you sane and get you through, actually. And I read loads of books, lots of books on, you know, grief and loss, and just trying to understand the journey and how different people had coped, really. And as I say, just finding a support network with the charity organisation, and then the family that we are now really good friends with who'd lost their child, you know. There's just something in that when you've had a shared experience. And as much as all our friends were brilliant, there is something about having gone through that loss yourself and knowing at each stage what that feels like. And unless you've been through it, you can't really know how that feels. So I think that was finding them and having them in our lives, and they're still in our lives, you know, made a massive difference, actually.
Well, thank you so much again. And yeah, over and out.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.